Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. In which we start a trip, perhaps a very long trip, into the global supply chain. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday today, October the 11th. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The supply chain in just a minute. But first, let us review, if we might, our energy coverage on this program the past week or so. Told you about the spike in natural gas prices here and globally last week. Followed that up with a story about high coal prices here and globally. Today we're going to talk about the rising price of the other fossil fuel, oil, of course. Both benchmarks, West Texas Intermediate, which is ours, and Brent North Sea Crude, which is global, closed above $80 a barrel today, first time that has happened in 7 years. So we got the guy at Marketplace who deals in all things energy to explain what's up and how long these high oil prices and, oh, by the way, high gas prices might stick around. Here is Andy Euler.
$80 a barrel? That sounds high, I guess, but 3.25 per gallon for gas at your local station? Now that's definitely high. Politicians know that, and some of them are arguing we need to get more U.S. producers to drill.
Gasoline at the pump is driving that discussion.
That's Eric Smith at the Tulane Energy Institute in New Orleans. That price at the pump could be due to Hurricane Ida, which shut down a lot of production. The Biden administration has asked OPEC to fill the gap, but Smith thinks that's a bad play, given all the reserves in the U.S.
It doesn't make a lot of sense for any kind of long-term economic development in the United States to shut down our long suit voluntarily so that other countries can exploit it.
Historically, at $80 a barrel, energy companies would be rushing to drill. And we have seen rig counts in Texas's Permian Basin inch up a bit. But Greg Priddy, an energy market consultant, says it's not the usual suspects.
It's not Chevron or ExxonMobil that are adding rigs in big numbers. It's the small independent wildcatters.
The bigger players are sitting out right now to protect investors' dividends. So the big question is, are they going to get in?
There will be somebody out there who is willing to put money in.
Eleanor Wald is president of Transversal Consulting.
The question is just, at what point will we see that happen?
Walt says it's not going to be overnight. New infrastructure is slow and expensive. But she also doesn't think prices are going to plateau at $80 a barrel. In Austin, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, selling into the close is the phrase you are looking for. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. I got in the car after work the other day, headed south about 25 miles or so, and wound up on a windy hilltop in San Pedro, California, so that I could have a look at what's become maybe the defining image of the global supply chain snafu.
That's a lot of boats.
That's a lot of ships, but as you can see, they're spaced out. Everybody's in their circle. Normally, you'd have a tenth of what we have out there.
Ships, boats. Same, same. Captain Kip Ludit is the executive director of the Marine Exchange of Southern California, which literally on that hilltop and electronically, as you'll hear in a minute, overlooks the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach.
And it's basically air traffic control.
Air traffic control at the busiest container port complex in the country. About 4,500 ships from China and Japan, Korea, and points west come through here every single year. We're talking about more than a third of all U.S. container imports.
Just to make sure I understand this, usually what happens is a ship calls you, container or otherwise, and you know it's coming because you've seen the schedule, and he says, hi, I'm here. and you say, go to berth 42, like almost same day-ish,
they,
probably.
They actually know 4 days in advance they're going to berth 42, and if you back up 2 weeks when the ships leave Asia, 2 week passage, in normal times, they're hitting their arrival time within 30 minutes. Because then the whole synchronization of the harbor pilot going out, then the tugboats meeting the ship, dock worker who plugs in the electrical cord, all of that is sequenced in a normal world.
Here's a little tidbit that shows you how not normal this world has become. The average wait time at the Port of Los Angeles right now is more than 11 days. In the before times, with ships hitting their arrival within 30 minutes after 2 weeks out on the water, it was basically zero.
And mathematically, there's supposed to be 0 to 1 container ships at anchor. 0 to 1.
Yes.
And today we have 66. So that's the magnitude of the backup that we have to take care of.
Which is why we're here. Those 66 ships on this today. What is today? Tuesday afternoon, right?
Correct.
There are, back of the envelope, 500,000 containers on those ships, with stuff inside destined eventually for American factories, then retailers and consumers. So we are starting a new series today called Temporarily Unavailable, about how stuff moves around the world, or doesn't.
So let me introduce Captain Pat Baranek. He's the general
manager. Good to see you.
Nice to meet you.
Somebody show me what's going on, because there's 66 ships out there, and they're not hanging around by themselves, right?
We'll show them out here.
Okay.
All right.
We'll follow you.
Come on out.
Sure.
We know why the ships are there, right? Pandemic buying binge by consumers. Pandemic worker shortages and factory shutdowns slowed the supply chain. Stuff started piling up, and the more stuff piled up, the longer the delays got. And then retailers started gearing up for the holidays, and here we are.
San Pedro traffic, Costco Nagoya.
Costco Nagoya traffic, good afternoon.
What they do here at the Marine Exchange is help those ships figure out where to wait and how to navigate all the traffic that's out on the water.
Information, the Mount Nicholson is passing the Long Beach Seabuoy, outbound to the southwest. Over.
In a room upstairs in the building on that hilltop, with big glass windows facing the ocean, most of the attention, honestly, is on a couple of three big flat-screen monitors.
So there's a defining line, basically a street called Navy Way, that breaks the port in half, L.A. Okay. Long Beach. So one port complex, but two different ports.
So we've got the schematic, and then out in the ocean, which I'm going to guess is the dark stuff here, right? Those circles are, how big are those circles?
The circles are 600 yards radius.
Radius. So they can swing an anchor 600,
yep.
600 yards.
Exactly. Yep.
Okay. This looks crowded.
It is crowded. I would say the most that it's ever been in the history of the port complex. So we're utilizing all of our anchorages plus our contingency anchorages. So we created additional anchorages that aren't charted.
Wow.
Then in addition to that, overflow-wise, now we have drift areas. So the vessels that are waiting to come into port are currently at anchor. Then we have an additional 31 that are sitting offshore, drifting, waiting for an anchorage spot or waiting to go into berth.
Like really drifting?
Like drifting.
So that doesn't seem entirely safe, if I could just as a layperson.
So unlike a car that can't stop.
Yeah,
obviously fair. The ocean's constantly moving. Current, wind, all that affects the vessel. The type of the vessel is affected differently by the conditions. And what happens for us is that means they're calling us about every hour and telling us, I'm going to turn my engines back on. They get back underway and then they move again, which means a lot of extra movement for us in addition to the number of vessels that are already in the area.
Right.
It's a lot more work, I would say astronomical, in terms of how much data that we're processing on a daily basis.
Do you ever stop to think that some huge chunk of the global economy comes through here? Does that, I mean, when you show up for work in the morning, you're like, yeah.
I think every day you have to know that, seeing what we see on a daily basis. I think we do sometimes take it for granted because we're doing this every day, but I think we always know that's what's happening.
Consumers take it for granted, too.
Oh.
Just, for the record.
Yeah.
90% of global trade moves on the water. And as of this weekend, there are still 60 container ships waiting outside the ports of L.A. and Long Beach.
Do you have a sense, or is it even your job to figure out how long this is going to last?
It is not. So, again,
it's not your job.
No, for us, 25 miles to Point Firmin, and out, we need to make sure all those vessels are safe. In terms of determining how long it's going to take, not our responsibility, which is good and bad.
Sorry, Kip, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, we do forecast out 3 days.
And, 72 hours.
So that's our horizon, and we actually love the media because you are going around asking, when will this end? Because we want to know when it will end, too.
I'm not sure anybody knows the answer to that one, but for the next installment in this series, we'll take a closer look at the container economy and how we got it. Hey, so you remember when the trade war was a thing? All those Trump-era tariffs on Chinese imports that we spent literally years covering? Yeah, well, it turns out, and we have mentioned this a couple of times, one of the few Trump-era policies that has continued into the Biden era is that trade war. Now, as we also spent years telling you, it's American consumers who wind up paying those tariffs, which perhaps explains the announcement by the U.S. Trade Representative at the end of last week that she is going to reopen the process by which American companies, and thus consumers, can get out of paying some of those import taxes. And the public comment period on it starts tomorrow. So Marketplace's Sabri Menashour has today's trade policy update.
There are some goods that, for now, U.S. businesses just can't get from anywhere else besides China. Nicole Bivens-Collinson is a trade lawyer with Sandler, Travis & Rosenberg.
Sometimes those products are proprietary. They are unique. They are patent protected. You can't just take that design that you've been making and licensed with the company in China and say, oh, I'm going to pick it up and now I'm going to move it over here to Indonesia and start making it.
Moving supply chains, she says, can take 4 to 5 years for complex components, and that's without a pandemic. Harlan Stone runs HMTX Industries, a luxury vinyl floor manufacturer. The firm still has most of its factories in China.
But we do use other countries now. But the capacity that's able to come on board, particularly during the pandemic, is a very limited percentage.
Some businesses were able to get out of paying the tariffs under the previous administration, but those exemptions expired. The Biden administration is saying those companies, and only those companies, can apply again to get out of the tariffs. Myron Brilliant is with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce.
The administration's finally getting around to recognizing that importers and small businesses are being hurt.
This also comes at a time when many businesses are struggling with supply chain problems. Richard Weiner is a partner at law firm Sidley Austin.
They are concerned about inflationary pressures, and this is a way where goods can be supplied in an efficient way when they aren't available from other sources.
Many businesses are hoping this represents a first step in loosening the tariffs on Chinese imports. Jake Colvin is president of the National Foreign Trade Council.
You know, the reality is that it's a small step. 500 products or so is kind of a drop in the bucket.
More than 50,000 companies applied for relief from the tariffs during the last administration. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I am personally a huge nerd.
I mean, same, really. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's down 250 points today, 0.7%, 34,496 on the blue chips. The NASDAQ down 93 points, about 0.6%, 14,486 there. The S&P 500 off 30 on the point scale, 0.6%. 43.61. Southwest Airlines dropped 4.1%. The carriers canceled, as you've heard, more than 2,000 flights since Saturday and blames bad weather, air traffic control issues, and staff shortages. Other airlines, Delta off 0.4%. American Airlines gained 0.2%. A lot of energy stocks rose in line with high oil prices, as Euler was telling us. Diamondback Energy sparked up 0.7%. Halliburton grew 3%. Bond prices unchanged with the U.S. bond market closed today for the holiday. The yield on the 10-year T-note, 1.61%. You're listening to Marketplace. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Squid Game, as you know, is pretty much everywhere right now. It's taken over TV screens. Its wardrobe selections have become top Halloween costumes. And now it and some of its Netflix cousins are going to Walmart. The country's biggest retailer is launching a dedicated e-commerce hub with the streamer to sell branded merchandise for its most popular shows. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that one.
You can't buy the Squid Game tracksuits or the freaky beekeeper-looking masks at Walmart. Just a t-shirt for now. Or perhaps you'd like a Stranger Things cassette player. That's available. Or a t-shirt from the cult Spanish show Money Heist.
It's odd.
Forrester analyst Sucharita Kadali says Netflix's portfolio doesn't exactly lend itself to Disney-style fly-off-the-shelf merchandise. I mean, Joe Exotic from Tiger King is no Baby Yoda.
Are they trying to go after like the eBay collectible crowd? Like, you know, the 40-year-old virgin crowd? Like, I don't know.
But Netflix doesn't need galactic-sized profits to benefit from a bigger merchandising footprint, says Ross Benish of eMarketer.
When you see people wearing Squid Game hoodies or shirts with Stranger Things, that is a free ad, essentially.
And it gives Walmart the opportunity to attract diehard fans who may transfer some of the fond feelings they have about the shows onto the retailer, says Barbara Kahn, a marketing professor at the Wharton School.
That is obviously not just about the transaction. It's about the overall experience and creating community around these brands.
Walmart's Netflix store will include a feature called Netflix Fan Select to crowdsource merchandise ideas from fans. How about an official Queen's Gambit chess set or Russian dolls, eh? I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Speaking of TV, as Megan McCarty-Carino just was, a piece in The Ringer caught my eye the other day about Survivor, now 600-some-odd episodes in, if you can believe it. Old seasons are finding new life on streaming services, and the post-Survivor economy for once and future contestants is, number one, it's a thing, and number two, it is thriving. Mara Rheinstein wrote about the opportunities for contestants who have left the island. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
So we're all used to reality TV stars, you know, having some kind of post-show life. That job market, though, you point out, has changed specifically for Survivor contestants.
Yeah, listen, Survivor has been around since 2000. If you could actually think back to 2000, what the technology was back in the day, there was none. If you did well on the show, you maybe hopped around to a few other reality shows that were on basic cable, and that was it. Now, 21 years later, everything has changed.
So they go out on social once they're done and they say, hey, this is me. And then I guess people find them and book them to do X, Y, and Z.
It is all about one word, and that is the brand. It is who their brand was, what their persona was, and how they can parlay it into success. Another avenue, listen, someone like a girl named Andrea Belke, who has played the show three times, has a segment on Good Morning America once a month. Another recent winner named Wendell Holland has his own show on HGTV. The most famous winner in the show's history, a guy by the name of Boston Rob.
I know Boston Rob.
See, you know who Boston Rob
is?
I do. That's how famous he is. He was just on a summer series on CBS. So you can see there's the old school way of parlaying your success into something like a Good Morning America, or there's a new school way doing Instagram, doing sponsored posts, doing TikTok, all sorts of things where they know who they are as an individual and they can parlay that and convey that to their audience.
All right. So look, I am not a Survivor watcher, but large swaths of my family is Survivor watchers.
You're missing out.
No, I'm actually not. And I will die on this hill. But anyway, I am thus familiar with the fact that some of the people on these show, on these seasons, all 41 of them, are jerks.
Yes, there are some villains. And guess what? The archetypal villain from back in the day who goes by Johnny Fairplay still can do cameos. He does appearances. He does podcasts. He still makes a good living based on being the quote unquote villain from back in the day. There really is endless possibilities because of social media.
Okay, so look, that's on the way out of the show, right? After they go on the show, however many times it is. Here's the question, though. Part of the beauty of these shows, it's the part of the fantasy of these shows is that you're watching everyday people plucked from, you know, the law or construction or, you know, what have you, plop down an island and trying to survive. Do you lose something if it's actually people angling for the post-survivor career?
I don't think so, because this is how it has been. You want to have a career after Survivor. I think everyone knows that's what it is. But just because you win, it doesn't mean you do win in the post game. You have to have a combination of factors that people really do want to root for you after the actual game is over.
You have to win the post game. Have you watched, by the way, for reals, all 41 seasons of Survivor?
Of course, I have watched all 41 seasons, but don't think of it like that. This is over 20 years. Anyone can watch 41 seasons of anything over 20 years. It's very possible.
Oh,
so no judgments.
No judgments at all. Mara Rheinstein, she's a contributor to The Ringer. Mara, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thanks a lot.
If you're a bibliophile, you'd best brace yourself for some shortages, much like a whole lot of other things in this economy. Publishers and wholesalers alike are sounding alarms that there are going to be some delays in getting books this winter because, yes, a lot of them are printed overseas, and also, yes, a lot of them are on those container ships we were talking about earlier in the program. So, if you run a bookstore, what do you do? Here's the latest installment of our series, today from New Orleans, My Economy.
My name is Candace Huber, and I am the owner of Tubby & Coo's Mid-City Bookshop. We sell genre books, so mostly science fiction and fantasy. I am personally a huge nerd, and that's what I like to read. And so when I open the bookstore, there's nothing in the city of New Orleans that catered to my little nerdy heart. And so I decided to open a store that did. And luckily, it turns out that a lot of other folks are passionate about those things as well. When the pandemic first started last year, I decided to close the store, of course, when everything else was closing. We've done really well with online orders and curbside pickup orders. And so because we've been doing so well with that, I haven't felt the need to reopen the doors. As of now, I am still closed for browsing, but hoping that things will get good enough that I feel comfortable opening again soon. One of the biggest challenges, especially with holiday season coming up, is the supply chain and being able to get books, being able to order books. Sometimes books will be on back order and they aren't able to print them as quickly as they used to be able to. We have seen price increases coming from publishers. So most of the time they're small price increases. So a book that was $16.99 might now be $17 or $18.99. I'm not as worried about that just because the price increases haven't been outrageous, at least yet. So I feel like that is something I'm not going to worry about unless we start seeing dramatic price increases across the board. Customers so far, I think, are vaguely aware of the supply chain issues, but we haven't really seen a lot of people start ordering up yet for the holiday season. I really hope that changes soon, but hopefully as we move into October, it will be a little bit more in people's minds. And as we start communicating that more to customers, hopefully we start seeing more orders rolling in.
That was Candace Huber selling books in New Orleans at their store Tubby & Coos. You've heard it before. I know you have because I've said it. But we really mean it. This series only works with your help. Tell us, would you, how your economy is doing at marketplace.org/myeconomy. This final note on the way out today with a little side eye at Jay Powell. Inflation is here. Get used to it. The CEO of Kraft Heinz said today, higher food prices are here to stay, pandemic or no. Yes, sure, supply chain glitches and labor shortages the past year and a half, but also too many people on the planet, he said, not enough arable land, demand, supply. Well, you all know how that goes, right? Okay, out of here we are, but here's your moment of economic context, cryptocurrency edition. Jamie Dimon, the CEO of arguably the most powerful bank in the world, that would be JP Morgan. Dimon said today he thinks Bitcoin is, and this is his word, worthless. Bitcoin today, up almost 2%. I am not here to tell you any of this makes any sense. Our daily production team includes Anais Amin, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Maria Honhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Minju Park. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdal. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's a speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.